Welcome to the 222 Paranormal Podcast. Straight out of Toledo, Ohio. The mean streets of Toledo, Ohio. It's Joe Shortridge.
Rolling Toledo style.
Toledo, what's up? Toledo Joe.
Yeah.
And his sister. The one, the only. Shoddy.
That's you.
Oh, that's me. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. We're excited to have you back.
Yeah.
Great to see everybody. And Joseph Dean, my brother, how are you today?
I'm relaxing.
Good. Good.
Busy week, but relaxing.
I know. It is. And when is it? Like this whole year has flown by. Flown by.
Big thing. We want to thank everybody that came out to our show.
Yes. Oh, my goodness, everybody. Thank you so much.
I was the one sitting in the corner rocking.
Yes. I can't even. No, it was great. We just can't thank everybody enough.
Yeah.
Very, very excited and thankful.
Got to listen to the speakers finally because we weren't sitting in our booth.
But yeah.
That was awesome.
It was. Thank you, everybody. We have a very, very exciting show for you today.
This is a super show.
It is a
super. This is a super show. Yep. This is one of the longest shows we've done. But I didn't want to cut it up because the strangeness that happened in our show, during the show.
You know, every once in a while, we'll do a recording and something strange happens during it. And you half wonder if somebody is monitoring.
I don't know
if it's paranormal. Is it conspiracy theory here that we're being listened to? Not sure, but we have an amazing, amazing guest for you today.
I never knew who she was.
I didn't either.
And we were sitting at Michigan UFO Contact,
which was a great convention.
Yeah, and we just started talking, and I was blown away.
You know, I had seen her picture on the poster.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a little research. I just want to give you guys a little bit of background of our guest today before we get into the interview, because it's so much information and so amazing. Like, you guys are going to be, your minds are going to be blown by this UFO information.
Now,
it is incredible.
I have to let you know, we lost about probably about 15 minutes of the show. And you'll hear it halfway through. It's the strangest thing. Like I said,
sometimes
things just happen.
It's weird because when Joe and I talk about UFO type information, we have this happen. So I don't know if it's a thing or if it's a thing or what.
Yeah, I know. The same thing happened when we interviewed Bill Konkoleski. I hit record. It was recording. And then all of a sudden I looked down. It's not recording.
That was interesting. It was at the same conference, and it was the UFO conference, and he's the Michigan director of MUFON, which is the Mutual UFO Network.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something to this, because this is twice with UFO information, and our show gets zapped out.
And it's not like we're doing it over the computer. We had just our little recorder and our microphones.
Big Brother's watching.
Yes.
So anyways.
Let's give a little background on her.
Okay,
Cheryl.
So our guest today is Cheryl Costa, and she's a native and resident of upstate New York. She saw her first UFO at 12 years old. She has retired from the aerospace industry. Mm-hmm. So she's just, you know, not somebody who has a theory, or she's done the homework. She's done the background. She is digging into what is going on out there with UFOs and sub-UFOs and different alien-type reports with MUFON, with other organizations.
Yeah. She does tons of research.
Right, and having that background in aerospace, and just when you listen, you guys are going to be blown away. She really has had a super interesting experiences with UFOs. With writing about UFOs, because she is a writer. She does have a weekly column in a New York newspaper, and she'll explain all that.
Yeah.
Specifically about UFOs. So I can't say enough. So
I was sitting there listening to her, and she was going through statistics and stuff, and I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah. And then all of a sudden she got into the other stuff that you're going to hear in a minute, And I was just like, what?
Mind blown. And I'll tell you after we come back from the interview what scared me.
Oh.
So it's a little teaser.
All right. So like you said, this is a super interview. It's like very long. It's almost an hour and a half long. So yeah.
So you guys.
So get in your comfy chair. Put on your tinfoil hat.
Yes, let's
get
do
some
it.
Cavassier or whatever you call it.
God, you're cracking me up today, dog.
And we'll be back after the interview.
Cavassier. Oh my God, that's hilarious. And with us today at the 2019 UFO Contact, we have a very special guest, Cheryl Costa. Welcome to the show, Cheryl.
Thank you very much.
Yes, we are so excited. I stalk you on Facebook and Twitter and all of the social medias. I love following everything that you have going on here. So what brings you to the UFO Contact today? I know you're a guest speaker.
Well, I,
I know that.
I was a guest speaker to talk about UFO statistics and some of the new numbers that I have just in the last couple of weeks. And I had them pretty riveted down there an hour ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's amazing. There's a lot of people at your speech. I popped my head in and I was like, oh, my gosh, lots. So where are you extracting these
statistics?
Where do you extract your statistics from?
Well, initially, we pulled... National UFO Reporting Center is publicly available on the internet, on the webs. So we pulled down each state, and then we merged them all, that type of thing. And you have to do a degree of cleanup because the data has been, I don't want to say hacked, but hacked is a good term.
Okay.
There's been some small corruptions in there, and we had to clean some of that up. And then MUFON had to be... when we did the first book in 2015, 2016 timeframe, I reached out about 5 months after we had worked on the National UFO Reporting Center database, and we were ready to look at MUFON data, and we'd already learned what we had to do to clean up the data.
Okay.
Of course, when we they made me go through hoops for about 3 months, and I just couldn't get it across to them because they kept thinking in terms of individual case studies, and they didn't know how to wrap their heads around the fact that I wanted a huge amount of data. And they started trying to ask me my project plan and all this other stuff, and I said, none of your business, you know. And finally, Linda is an executive in her day job, and she got on the phone with them for about 15 minutes. 20 minutes later, I had the file, you know. So, nice. You know, sometimes it's better to let a business head do this stuff. And then they gave it to us. And then the next time I wanted data from them, well, Jan Hardison has a copy laying on his desk now.
Yeah.
You know, so I simply drop him an email now and say, I need what, when, where, time, all that kind of stuff. And I tell him exactly what the fields are I want. And usually in about a week, when one of his people pulls it, and I get a common delimited file. Now, you have to understand, I only ask for what, when, where, and what shape, and what time, that kind of thing. I don't have the write ups.
Okay.
I don't have the personal information of the people, and they were very concerned about that issue. I said, I don't want it. We're only doing a study of frequency distribution and shapes.
Okay.
You know, but there was a big fear that I was going to out people, and I said, no, I don't do that in my newspaper column, and I don't have that information from your data. I'm just crunching a specific narrow window of data to do a study.
Is there a certain state that has the more activity? Than others that you found in your data?
Well, the top three states have been pretty stable since 2007. Is California.
Okay.
Florida and Texas. Now, for the people who point at California, well, they got all the population. Well, yes, but California's a unique thing. It crosses 9 lines of latitude, so it has 3 different climates.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we discovered that latitude and climate has a great deal to do with the UFOs, or with the sightings. What happens is, Linda looked at me when we were working on the first book and said, one afternoon, I was working on the analysis, and I didn't really look at the charts after I plotted them. I just gave her the objects and sent them over to her. And she said, did you notice there's a difference at latitude for like the monthly chart? I said, what are you talking about? In the northern states, it was like a certain quiescent number. You get around June, July, August, it goes up like a rocket, and then it falls right back off again in September. And we found out that the people who are running along all year long are the dog walkers and smokers. And when you get into fair weather, you get the fair weather viewers, you know. And the dog walkers and smokers are out there day in, day out, rain or shine. And we thought that was the pattern every place the summer months would be peaking out. When you move down to the middle level states like Maryland and going across, that peak starts coming down and all those other numbers sort of come up.
Okay.
And then when you get in deep south states, it becomes statistically fat and it's a little dippy in the middle because it's too hot to go outside and you know, that kind of thing. And that was an eye opener.
Okay.
And Linda caught that one, and I was as shocked as anybody to see it.
Do you think that because California, Florida, and Texas have such a large landmass on the coast, do you think being on the water like that has anything to do with why they want to appear in those, but not
on the water?
Okay.
Not the water itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
After our book came out, I had a map in there of all the census districts of states, right? And I had it laying in my lap. We were on a commercial break for a radio program. And I happened to be looking at it, and I noticed that all the states that were touching the Great Lakes, like Michigan, you know, and all that, all the Great Lakes states had sightings in the many thousands, 3,000, 4,000, that kind of thing, for the 15-year period. And then you move two states away, and the numbers fell in the low hundreds.
Okay.
Okay. Now, but let's take put that in perspective. I did an article for my column where I said that 19% of the sightings in New York State were on the St. Lawrence Seaway, and another 17% were in the Finger Lakes, and another 30% were down the Hudson, in the Hudson Valley, sighting range. Everybody thought, well, it's the water. Well, no. Let's go back to your 16th, 17th, and 18th century, 19th century history. Where did people build? They built next to water. Water gave them water. Water gave them irrigation. Water gave them transportation. Okay, and those populations are still there. So it isn't necessarily about the water in terms of like USOs, that kind of thing. It's more in the context of that's where the population is. And we know that population, temperate weather, leisure time, and hours of darkness are the three principal drivers.
Yeah, because that's, like you mentioned, darkness, so it's easier to see them in the dark. Because to me, it is. Because, like, right now, if we went outside by the lake here, you're looking up and the sky is pretty bright. You know? And to me, I feel that we won't be able to see them as good unless they're black, you know?
Yeah, but the thing you got to keep in mind is the hours of darkness and leisure time are usually coincident with each other.
Okay.
Okay, and you got to keep that in mind. Give an example. Day of the week, 76% of the states, it's Saturday night. And there's a handful of states that it's down in Wednesday and Thursday nights. And they're mostly southern states. And our interns happened to look at that, and they were from down south. And they said, well, that's Bible study night.
Oh.
Okay, so when is it? It's leisure time.
Uh-huh.
It's during hours of darkness. Okay, it's the availability. This study is less about why the UFOs are there and more about the patterns of the human observers. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that was something we had to learn the hard way ourselves, you know.
My question is, like, what drives you? Why is this your passion? You know, like, you had an experience when you were young. Can you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about started?
Two sightings that I had before I was 20. One was 12 years old in 1965. It was a late August afternoon. We had been visiting an uncle up in a farming district in the southern tier of New York. And we were coming down off the hill on a dirt road. The corn was taller, certainly taller than our car. And my mother saw something, had my father pull off the road, and she pointed out into a clear blue western sky, and there was this shiny silver ball out there, like a rock. Now, I'll give you an idea how big it is. Lay your arm out there and look at your little fingernail. That's how big it was out there in the sky.
Okay.
And it sat there, and my mom explained to me it might be something the Air Force was doing. It might be a weather balloon. And then she said NASA was only 5 years old at that point. And she says, might be something NASA's doing, you know. And she said, might be people from another world.
Mm-hmm.
And that fascinated me as a 12-year-old. You know, my brothers and sisters were toddlers, so they were oblivious to what we were talking about. And then we got back on the road. Got down to the bottom of the dirt road, down the bottom of the hill, turned onto the state tar road and turned left and started heading back towards our hometown. And I crawled up in that big window of that old Chevy Impala.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm sitting there and I'm wondering, who are you guys? Who are you guys? You know? And when it decided to leave, it was like you see in the Starship movies. Gone.
Hmm.
You know? And that was the first one. 6 years later, I'm in the Air Force. I'm in Cameron Bay, Vietnam. It's a middle part of the country. It's a big, it's like Virginia Beach. It's a big sandbar peninsula out. So it's away from the jungle. It's literally desert.
Oh my gosh.
It's a big sandbar. And it was a clear Christmas. It was Christmas Eve, 1971, about 11:30 at night. We were again facing west. I was looking at constellation Taurus. Okay. And I'm walking along. I've always been lightly into astronomy, and I'm as an adult, I'm into one of my hobbies is radio astronomy. I do radio astronomy work with. I'm a ham operator. Yeah. I got all the equipment, you know. And we're walking. A friend of mine and I were walking to the base chapel to go to midnight mass. I wasn't Catholic anymore, but it was something to do. So we went down there for tradition, and we were walking along. And we saw this streak going across the sky. And yeah, it's a jet, and then it stops. And we're sitting there, and Tom, it stopped. Yeah, I know. Can't be a helicopter. It was moving too fast. Yeah, I know. You know, if it's what I think it is, it's going to start dancing around. Darn if it didn't start dancing around like not like a fairy, and then gone. Wow.
What color was it?
Oh, it was just a white light in the sky. It's all we could see. And two of us got to midnight mass. Our mind was not on the services, believe me. I didn't tell anybody that story till about 15 years ago.
Oh.
Because I drank the Kool-Aid like everybody else. Mm-hmm. Don't tell anybody. They'll think you're a kook or a crackpot, you know. Yeah. And I just didn't tell anybody. But I was a lot of people, when I started writing my UFO column, a lot of people said, this chick fall out of the sky or something, you know. Who the hell is this, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, the thing was, I had been reading in high school after that sighting with my mother. We both went to the library and got books. In those days, it was like Frank Edwards and Jack Anderson and a bunch of people like that. And whenever we got a book, one of us would read it and kind of give the other like a little book report and a synopsis what it is. And if the other one wanted to read it, they did. Our book from Eric Von Daniken around 68, she dog-eared on the top. I dog-eared on the bottom. Our book was trashed. Honest to God, it was terribly trashed. So I was rather well-read, and anything I ever saw that came out, I grabbed and read it, okay? But I wasn't a fanatic about it, just read everything. In 1990, I got hospitalized, but I was on a business trip. Mm-hmm. Before I left on the business trip, I put my apartment, everything in my apartment, into storage because I was going away for a three-month thing, and I had planned to get into a new apartment when I got back. Mm-hmm. And so I went off on the business trip. And while I was in the business trip, I got hospitalized for emergency abdominal surgery.
Oh, no.
So I come back. I don't have an apartment to go to.
Oh.
So I called a friend of mine, and he said he's a Wiccan friend of mine. And I called him up, and he says, hey, look, my father's on chemotherapy. I'm staying at his house. Here's the keys to my place in Laurel, Maryland. Go over there, stay as long as you like, a month, 3 weeks, whatever you want. You know, feed the cat. And I'm staying with my father, and there's no cable, but I got a lot of books. So I thought, oh, okay. I figured everything over there was going to be some high, heady thing. I get in there, and he's got first editions of all the best UFO books printed to that date.
Oh, man, that was like meant to be.
Yeah, like 400 books in there. Everything Stanton Friedman had published to that point, you know?
Okay.
And, of course, no cable. So I was there 6 months before the condo I wanted to get into was available. So I just, I went to college, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, I read books every night, you know? So I was rather well-read on it. Mm-hmm. Again, all those years, I couldn't join a group like MUFON. My mother had an application for MUFON when I was in high school, 68, 69,
oh, wow.
frame. It came out, a little mimeograph letter.
Oh, nice.
But she didn't join it. And I'm glad I didn't at the time, because later it would have affected whether or not I have a security clearance.
Yeah.
Okay. So after I was out of the military, both branches, Air Force and Navy, and I was in Lockheed Martin again, I had a clearance, so I really didn't get deep into it. And then when I retired, I went to work for a newspaper because I wanted to take a different career path, okay? And I went to work for a paper. I was in the technical department. I made 400 plates every night to make the print the paper.
Oh.
Okay. It don't make it sound like we're pouring lead or anything.
Yeah.
Imagine cookie sheets being hit with like a big laser printer type of thing. Okay. That's how it's done now. And now it's like instead of going through a big bath, now it's like a shake and bake oven. They hit it with the laser, and then it goes through a thing like a shake and bake oven and just bakes it on. And then when it gets to the other side, they literally just hit it off with a spray. You know, it's really good technology. But
papers are going away too. You know, like it's kind of a
yes and no, yes and no. My paper just closed up, but it was a function of advertising and advertising dollars being stolen by other. Newer other venues of advertising and things.
Okay.
A lot of readers that would be coming up are reading on their phones.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
So what ended up happening was I was working at the paper. We just put all the plates on the press. 700-ton, three-story Swiss press. And it started rolling, and all we had to do was sit back and wait 90 minutes or 2 hours, depending upon the edition, and let it go, and then we could go home.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And I went on CNN.com to see what the news was, and there was this little sidebar story that said, UFOs have been declining since the 1980s. Maybe they were always just an urban legend.
Oh
no.
150-word misinformation article.
I looked at
that thing and I said, oh, these aren't the droids you want, you know, that kind of mentality. So later that night, I went to, first time in my life I'd ever gone to one of the reporting services. I went to the National UFO Reporting Center, crawled back into their website a little bit, found some year-end totals and wrote them down, dropped them into a little Excel spreadsheet, and the curve went up like this.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, what memo didn't the UFOs get, you know?
Yeah.
And that was the start of it. It was November 5th, 2012 was when that article was published. The next evening, the next couple of evenings, after the press was rolling, I started looking at the reports that people said. And you know, to a degree, I drank the Kool-Aid too, thinking, they're cooks, nuts, and idiots, you know. And I started reading it, and most of these reports, if they had any substance to them, were just people trying to get it off their chest. It was very obvious in the language. We saw something amazing. We never really thought about this stuff, but there it was, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just finishing up my bachelor's degree 40 years later type of thing. And I was finishing it up, and I was doing it in entertainment writing, essentially of journalism, but it's got a little bit different slack to it. And I typed up a couple articles, and I wrote them up very matter of fact, very much like you'd report Joe Jones had this car accident, Susie's house burnt down, you know.
Yeah.
I put it in the same matter-of-fact tone any other newspaper article was. Went around to about 12 or 13 editors, got chased out of the office, got screamed out of the office, got escorted to the door by security, you know. And finally, I reached out to a little weekly paper, Syracuse New Times.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the new editor-in-chief over there was a guy by the name of Larry Dietrich, independent senior copy editor, and they bought him out over at the Post-Standard where I was working. So I called Larry up and I said, hey, Larry, can I come over and pitch you something? Hey, I hear you've been out there pitching. And I said, yeah, I guess the word's getting around.
He says, come on
over, let's talk. So I got over there and he broke us out a couple of cups of tea and said, let's talk first before I look at your stuff, you know? And as we got discussing it, he shared with me he had a sighting when he was a teenager. And he had turned out he read all the same books I had, Frank had, all those old writers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about it, and then about 20 minutes later, and he just looked at me and says, I'm sympathetic. So he said, let me see what you got. I passed 5 articles to him, about 400 or 500 words apiece. And
okay.
He looked at me and said, I'll try you out for a month. And this was very much the tone of, like, in The Princess Bride, there's this line, Wesley, I'll most likely kill you in the morning. And he says to me, he says, I'll try you out for a month, and I'll probably take you off. So, okay, at least you're giving me a chance. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Yeah. A month later, I get this phone call. He says, Cheryl, we need to talk. Get over here. Here we go.
Yeah. You know?
So I parked my car. The garage, they got the parking lot torn up, so I had a hell of a time finding a parking place. I get up there. I'm 10 minutes late. I come into the room where they're having a meeting. All the columnists are sitting around this big board table, and they're all dressed in a nines. I'm coming in a T-shirt and jeans. And Larry stops talking, looks at me, and points over at me by the door and says, there's our rock star.
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, what are you talking about? And all the columnists are going like this. And he says, you're pulling more page views than all of them combined.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. That's
incredible. And then he says, keep doing what you're doing. About 3 months later, he calls me over again, and he says, you're pulling more page views than all of our features in the paper combined. About 6 months later, the digital editor reaches out to me and says, Cheryl, you've got international fanship. You're about 400 readers in Europe, and we've counted 17 or 18 in Russia, you know, and we're going, huh? You know, and you've got this national fanship. We're a weekly.
Wow. Okay. That's incredible.
Yeah.
You feel like people just have that thirst for knowledge about this? Like they want good, solid information. They just don't want some, you know, hokey information on the internet, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, yes and no. And part of it was, as you know, a lot of UFO articles, if they were reporting in the paper, they were always with a condescending tone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And they're real. Uh-huh. You know,
yeah.
You'd see a report of a UFO on the local TV station. Maybe the stringer did a great job with the story. When they cut back to the anchor, they'd always kind of roll their eyes at the audience before cutting the commercial.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah, or put the X-Files song on it or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. There was always this condescending attitude mm-hmm. towards it. So here I am writing stories like a normal newspaper story. Though some people wrote and said, how come you're reporting stories from 15, 20, 30 years ago? And my commentary back in one of my columns was, they weren't reported then, so I'm reporting them now.
Yeah.
They're still, you never heard them, so they're news.
Right,
you know,
right.
It doesn't matter that they happened 15 years ago, you know. And people were enjoying that. And my digital editor came to me and wanted me to put up a Facebook page. And he wanted me to share the column on the Facebook page, maybe in some of the groups, which we did. And that just made it skyrocket even more. It really surprised the heck out of us. Hmm. And part of it was we found out from talking to people, he did a marketing study, a lot of women reading it.
Okay.
Okay. The women were very deeply interested in it, and the age range was in the late 20s, usually the early 30s into the 60s and 70s. Okay. And look at the crowd.
Yeah.
Okay. And there was that. And then what ended up happening too was he realized that there was a sincere interest. And we found a 2012 poll done by the National Geographic before one of their programs came on. And it said that 36% were true believers, 42% were on the fence, 17% says BS, mm-hmm. okay? But 80% believed that the UFO, that the government was not telling us what it knew. That's the on the fence people, okay? So when I was pitching to Larry, I gave him those demographics, and he knew, because of his own interest, he knew darn well it was going to be, he told me in the preface for our new book that's coming out, we're publishing all the articles in a trade paperback. All 237 articles. Okay.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And in fact, the editors are working on it this weekend. And I formatted them all, got them, recovered them off the server and cleaned them up, got the HTML tags out of it and all that stuff. But the point that was made to us, he wrote it up in the preface for our book. He said, I knew it would be interesting, more interesting than anything we had. And I suspected it would be the kind of thing that someone would read and they would share the link with friends. And there was this, somebody told somebody, two people told somebody else, mm-hmm. and it just mushroomed.
Wow.
And depending upon the article we put. Now, the first year we were publishing, we got censored. Not by the paper.
But by who?
Of 237 articles that I wrote, only one article got spiked.
What's that mean, spiked?
Okay. There's censorship when we say, we're not going to let you say that. We're not going to let you say that. Spike means we're not going to print this article.
Oh.
And in old newspaper terms, there was like a little stand there with a big spike on it, and the guy would just put it there, and it wasn't going anywhere.
Okay.
Okay. They spiked it. Why? Because it was snarky.
Oh.
And they felt by that point when I wrote it, it was late 14, early, oh, it was 2015. And they felt that I had established such a gravitas as a journalistic authority on UFOs. And I had a scientific approach and I had a very pragmatic approach to everything. They felt that it would hurt my reputation to do a snarky, humorous article. Okay, in the book, we're going to publish that article.
Oh, that's
okay.
Cool.
The nature of the article, you'll love it. It was along this line. Okay, let's assume a disclosure has happened. Okay, it's a few years down the line. A disclosure has happened. The president's been on. He's introduced a couple of off-world representatives and dignitaries. What's going to happen? Well, right off the bat, we're going to have a bunch of people who are going to go off their rockers. Because they never believed any of this stuff. See, the other thing, all those people who made a lot of fun of us have suddenly become subject matter experts and pushed the rest of us out of the business.
Right.
The ETs are now going to be the fair-haired pop darlings of the marketing industry, and they're going to get they're going to be used for advertising all kinds of themes of off-world perfumes and all this stuff like this. You know, we may even see the daytime shows like The View or Ellen or something like that have guys like Travis Walton and Whitley Strieber come on and have a conciliatory moment with the aliens that took them back in the day, you know.
Yeah.
And that time. And of course, the late night commercials would, of course, have something from the attorneys. The attorneys to say, as of 2023, we've signed galactic treaties with off-world people. You are now eligible for compensation if you were abducted, had lost your job because of this, and went down through this whole, had your cattle mutilated, all this kind of stuff, you know. If you've had any of these things happen, contact the law firm of Petrova, Jameson, and that was the flavor of it.
Yeah.
And anybody, I actually published it on... Rogue Planet TV with Jason McCullen and Ryan published it.
Okay.
And I gave it as a special to them. And I thought it was really funny, and a number of other people did too, but they said, you know, this is too close to the truth. And
that's true.
You think? You know.
Life imitates
so that was the flavor of it, and that's the only one that got spiked. But we had a problem with censorship. The first 2 years my articles were up, if I wrote a story that said, like, Susie and her dad went to the ice cream parlor to get some custard, and while they were standing in line, they saw three silvery objects fly overhead, followed by Air Force jets. You couldn't find it on Google.
Yeah.
If you knew the URL at the newspaper or were looking at the newspaper, you could find it. But if you Googled today's New York skies at Syracuse New Times, you wouldn't find the article. And we found out years later, that the NSA had its fingers into Google for years, you know. So after I saw this happen a couple of times, I told my digital editors, and he said, he patted me on the head. Nah, don't worry about it. And then he came to me and said, I think we have a problem. After he saw a few issues,
because you mentioned the Air Force specifically.
Anytime you mentioned the military interacting with them.
Gotcha. Okay.
So he went to the editor in chief and told him, and he said, he patted him on the head, you know. And then after about a year, the editor in chief and the digital editor sat down with me and says, we have enemy action. So what we did was, there's a UFO Digest out of Toronto, Canada.
Okay.
And they sometimes copied our articles. So we made an arrangement with Dirk, the guy that arranged it. If you can't find us on Google on Friday afternoon after 6 o'clock, go directly to the paper, make sure we put an article up. And if we did, copy it and repost it there outside of the country.
Oh.
And he did. And that's how we beat it.
Okay.
Wow.
And after that, nobody monkeyed with us.
That's a little... You know, just thought-provoking that they are monitoring all this. You know, like
the Men in Black.
Exactly.
It's a classic, like, Men in Black.
It just makes you think, like, okay, what else is being monitored? Is our podcast being monitored, John?
Well, probably.
Nobody listens.
When we were working on the book,
yeah,
it was an 18-month project. Mm-hmm. When we got down to the last 6 months, we were getting paranoid as hell because we had a lot of data cleaned up. Reports were becoming, we were going, oh my God, look at this, you know. And as we were making reports and charts, we were becoming very enlightened. And we said, oh, this is tricky. We wanted to go on a business trip or something or go out to a UFO conference. We were afraid the house would get broken, burnt down or something like this. So we started every weekend. We went out and bought a dozen flash drives. And every week we would take whatever that subdirectory was that had all the current data for it. We would back it up onto the thumb drive and put it in a sealed envelope, sealed like 5 by 11 envelope.
Yeah. Okay, not to be rude or anything, but a strange thing just happened as we were doing our interview here, and we don't know what.
Strange things happen during lots of interviews.
We're sitting here talking. I look down. It's not recording again. And we're talking about disclosure. And
yeah. They're outside listening to us with giant
talking about
earphones.
Black vans.
If they can shut down missiles in a missile silo in Montana, they can turn off your
little recorder here. So I have no clue when it stopped.
All right. Well, let me re-ask my question about it. What's your opinion, or do you feel, or do you believe that they are concerned of how humans are treating the planet Earth?
Yes. First, refer to the Dr. Edgar Mitchell Foundation studies again. Almost everybody came back and said, "Told us to tell you to take care of the planet." That seems to be a very big deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There are, my friend Tom Conwell, colleague. Is in Troy, New York. Tom has taken data like I've got from my. Mm-hmm. We shared data reports with him, and he went out and did studies to see what was going on in these places since we had county data, and he did studies and what he kept coming back with is, jeepers, they seem to be hanging out around our most polluted lakes, most polluted rivers, our dead strip mines, coal mines, dead oil fields, dead gas fields, brown fields, all that kind of stuff. They seem to be radioactive areas. They seem to be incredibly interested in all this stuff.
Yeah, I wonder because it's like, you know, I don't know what interest that they would have in us keeping the planet. I don't know.
Well,
these planets are rare.
Yeah. They're rare. And
they have such diverse life.
That's the
plants,
thing.
Plants, animals, humans.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a lot of these planets out there that, you know, we're finding new planets all the time.
Yeah, pretty much every day now.
But the thing is, there's something special about this one. We are a fledgling culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of showed people, they were protecting us. They were helping our culture. Mm-hmm. Talk to ancient alien guys. I'll tell you, they were influencing our culture. They were teaching us laws, that kind of stuff. And until we set off a nuclear bomb three nuclear bombs in 1945, they didn't consider us to be much of a threat of anything. But suddenly now we've got a new box of matches, and they're a little concerned.
Yeah.
And as it was put to me, they don't want us getting off this rock and eating their neighbors.
Yeah. You know, I saw that one thing. It said when aliens fly by, they lock their doors.
Yeah. And I wouldn't disagree with that. We're a highly violent culture. Mm-hmm. I've heard several of the experts I was talking. I was coming. If you had had a recorder going, I wish I'd had my Tascam with me.
Yeah.
When I was coming up here in the bus, we had a 3-hour trip, and it was me, Ryan, Nick Redfern, Frank Chili, and myself. And we had a 3-hour drive getting here, and it was the woo-woo talk from hell.
It must have been amazing.
It was amazing because what one didn't know, the other did. Yeah. And it was the most interesting compilation of knowledge of things that were being shared, spanning, 100 years worth of stuff. And it was really cool talk. And like I said, we stopped for gas at one point, and I'm in the ladies' room saying, God, I wish I brought my Tascam.
Yes.
God, I wish I brought that digital recorder with me. You know? It would have been amazing.
Yeah.
But the deal is, they seem to be extremely interested in our culture. They've been taking care of us. They were worried about our nuclear. We were very close to Armageddon back in the 80s, and they started shutting down our missiles and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to show them, we can do this. You should do this and stop monkeying around with this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
and they're worried about us. And I tend to look at them as good shepherds. And people say, well, they're going to eat us. I said, they could have eaten us a long time
ago. That's just it, yeah.
You know, and as far as invading
us. Humans eating humans then.
You know, they, you know, I point to, you know, 1561, the battle, that Star Wars battle over Nuremberg, Germany, and then again, Basel, Switzerland, two different weekends. And they could have done it to us then, mm-hmm. or somebody was trying to do it to us then. But there seems to be a bigger force of galactic wisdom out there, and we're a protectorate. You know, we had islands out in the Pacific that USA was a protectorate of, you know. So I think that that's what we're dealing with. And again, the Edgar Mitchell Foundation people found out from talking to the experiencers that they want us to wake up consciously and realize that we are part of them, they are part of us. Now, this is me, the monk, the former Buddhist nun, talking. We are connected, and this is going to sound like Star Wars. We're connected to every living thing, everywhere, every when. Yeah. And all we have to do is clear our consciousness a bit enough that we can realize that we are connected and feel them. And I know mystics on this planet who feel them and touch them and talk to them on a regular basis. But it's because their consciousness is cleared enough that they're aware of them. They've been with us all along. We just don't see them. We didn't see the guy hit the button on your thing. You know, it's that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They say they've been with us forever, and so we're just not capable of seeing. Well, when did the Nimitz start being able to see them? Those F-18s had just gotten new technology on them that let them see in the infrared range. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Guess what? Our cell phones, you'd make a nice picture of the family at the picnic, and after you look at the picture, what's that thing out in the sky? The cell phones can see down into the infrared range. Who knew?
Yeah.
So they're operating just outside of the field of our color vision.
Do they tone down those videos that they release, like from the pilots? Do they, I don't want to say dumb it down, so people don't see all of our technology, mm-hmm. like the Russians get all our technology?
Yeah, yeah. They did dumb it. They had to dumb it down, and the parts that were released were not the juicy parts, but they were telling parts. Okay. The juicy parts are what the congressmen and senators are getting in the Navy classified briefings. Okay, point one. That's what I suspect they're getting. The other thing that kind of dumbed down, even with stuff that they released on September 16th, okay, with that news, political and New York Times article, I watched all the pundits, like on CNN and things like this. They were sitting there looking like a deer in the headlights, trying to talk about a topic they are not prepared to talk about, for one. And as a journalist, I was really, you did not want to hear the language I was using. But the other thing was, they were looking at the video saying, well, it could be the Chinese, it could be this, it could be that, you know. So everybody's testing something, their aviation expert says. But they're looking at the image. They're not listening to that audio when that pilot says, wow, did you see that turn? Oh, my God, there's a whole fleet of them.
Yeah.
And I wrote an article immediately after that and says, what are these people looking at? They're talking about this stuff, trying to discredit it, and they're not listening to the soundtrack that there's a whole fleet of them. I've written articles, mm-hmm. about people who saw in telescopes in the 1940s, whole fleets of them flying at ultra high altitude. One of these stories was told up at Syracuse University in February 1947. That's before Arnold.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
That's before Roswell.
And there's people.
You know what you don't hear about?
What's that?
About Roswell. Okay. And a lot of people tend to say, you know, get a new TV program out. Oh, it all started with Roswell. Baloney.
No. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, okay, what people don't know, do you know that there were sightings from 38 states at that time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you know that those sightings have been going on since early June through late July? Okay. That's a lot of sightings. But the goofy thing, most people do not know that. And right around the time of Roswell, there was a peak of almost 700 sightings. Okay? Now, was Roswell the crash? A lot of people, there are experts that say they think the crash did not happen in early July. They say they think it happened in early June.
Okay.
And I called up Stanton Friedman. I was researching something completely different for an article. I was looking back in the New York Times articles, looking at it. And I called him up and I said, has anybody ever pointed out that we had almost 2 months worth of sightings going on? And it almost looks like, you know, when an airplane, a little airplane goes down, they send out the Civil Air Patrol to mm-hmm. look for them. I said, does anybody ever say to you that this looks, that whole 1947 flap was Starship down on a hostile planet, Galactic Federation respond kind of thing? And he said, yeah, actually it did. And in the 1960s, a guy by the name of Ten Blocher did, he's an actor. And he was on the road as a professional actor, and he was on the road. So he worked at night. He spent his afternoons in the local libraries, wherever the tour show was in. And back in those days, reports were in the newspapers. He'd go back and look in their morgues of everything from June to mm-hmm. the end of July. And if there was clippings, he made notes about it and all this kind of thing. He came back and wrote a paper, and you can buy it. It's on the internet. Mm-hmm. You can find it. It's called UFO flap in 1947. You Google that, you'll find this thing by Ted Boecher Blocher.
Okay.
And you can buy an updated version of it on Amazon too, amazingly enough. But there was something bigger going on, and that even lended more support to the idea that either Roswell or the crashes that were associated, we now call Roswell, and that one further on, really did happen. And maybe all these sightings where people were, galactic folks were down here doing the proverbial search and rescue.
Yeah.
That's what it seems to be to the logical observer. I showed it to some people I know on a Civil Air Patrol, and I showed them the data, and one of the kids made a remark. He says, wow, Starship down, you know, and that was the tone.
So, yeah, I've never thought of that.
How many crashes do you think there are or has been, or do you have any data on, like, specific, you know, how many times a UFO has crashed on?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I never went after that.
Because you hear about Roswell, but yeah, I don't but really hear about okay, first other thing. Ones.
Linda and I, were as women researchers have gotten a very bad rap in astronomy and chemistry, all the sciences mm-hmm. and things like this. They make discoveries, and excuse the expression, some white guy took credit for it.
Okay.
All right. Well, there was all this, when I started writing my newspaper column, there was all this old guard.
Mm-hmm. I've been studying UFOs for 30 years. Who the hell are you? You know, mm-hmm. and why are you writing about UFOs? What do you know about them? You know,
that they don't know it. I've been studying them since I was in seventh grade, you mm-hmm. know.
Right.
But the bottom line was, you looked at it and you look at this whole mess and say there was a need to cut a niche out for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know what that niche was. I was making a niche doing the journalism. I mean, there weren't that many mainstream journalists that were doing regular UFO columns. There was the guy over at Huffington, Spiegel, that did them. But, you know, that type of thing. But that was about it. There wasn't a whole heck of a lot else. Probably, I think Steve Bassett there told me there couldn't have been more than 12 reporters in the country who were writing these stories. Okay, the crashes. Linda and I looked at it and said, you know, let's study 21st century information since it's new and everybody else seems to be entrenched in the 20th century. In fact, UFO books up until that point seemed to sound like an FM radio station. The best UFO crashes from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, right. You know, and it was like an oldies station.
Yeah.
And it did. And Linda said, let's do something different. One, we're going to study, we're going to do science. We're going to do frequency distribution and shapes. We're going to do only 21st century stuff. Okay, we're 18, 20 years into this century. Let's do 21st century stuff and carve out our own niche. Okay, and nobody's been here besides us.
Have you ever been on a crash site?
No.
I have all these random questions.
Ask me the hard question.
Okay.
Why are we here? No.
I want to know, like, their physical description. We always hear about grays. What other types have been seen outside of grays?
Can they be
this big? Can they be, you know, giant,
that's
enormous?
The thing.
All of the above.
You never know.
You know what I cranked about?
What irks you?
I get cranked about. I get very cranked when I hear, I'm going to hate myself for saying this.
Only on the 222 podcast.
I promise not to go woo-woo. Okay.
No, we want woo-woo. No, okay. We love it. We need it.
I'm sick of people trashing the reptilians. Okay. They don't know them. Mm-hmm. And they, I do. Mm-hmm. And they don't know them. And the stupid thing about it is we have this cultural contamination in our, comes down through the Bible about the snake in the garden, yeah, and all that stuff, you know. And even some Christian groups will say, you know, no, it was a dragon in the garden, you know. Okay, fine. Well, the bottom line is this. That cultural contamination, if it had been a squirrel that talked to Eve, we would hate squirrels.
Right.
So, and you hear all these people on the internet saying, oh, reptilians, oh, they're going to eat us. Oh, you know, not the ones I know. Okay. They're as gentle as any monk or nun I knew in the monastery. And they're smart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they've been here longer than we have. Okay. And that's the point. Mm-hmm. And the one I met in a monastery on a late Saturday night. Looked like a normal human being until he dropped his glamour.
Wow.
And I didn't flinch. And he said, I haven't scared you. And, you know, it was a very humanoid reptile person. And watched the five fingers, mutate to four or three.
Okay.
You know? And, the conversation, we got the very, very good conversation. The way our temple worked is we had a 24-hour prayer shift that's been going on for 20 years. So somebody's there every 2 to 3 hours doing this prayer shift. There's a certain practice you do, but if guests came in, you give them tours and things. You're also kind of a watch guard kind of thing. And Saturday nights, I was a Buddhist nun. We don't drink. We were celibate, so it wasn't like you're going to go out and lift beers and chase tails, excuse the expression, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so I used to sign up for Saturday nights a lot. Until I got my Saturday night talk radio program like this, yeah, you know. And when Art Bell went off the air, my old general manager called me up and said, could you do a show like Art Bell? And I said, yeah, I probably could. We thought you could. You know? So, but I was in the temple, and remember, I was an ordained Buddhist nun, buzz cut, the Dalai Lama robes. I was an ordained Buddhist nun. And this person came in a couple different times on Saturday night, sometimes sat there and just meditated in front of one of the altars, sometimes would say hi and talk to me, and sometimes I'd do walking meditation. We'd walk around the temple doing the walking meditations together. Mm-hmm. And then one night he says, I want to find out just what your metal is. And I says, what do you mean? He says, have you seen everything? Do you scare easily? And I said, no, I've seen a lot of strange things. My family's clairvoyant, for God's sakes, you know.
Yeah.
It runs down my mother's side of the family, okay. You know. And I said, I've seen things go bump in the night, and I saw who did it, you know.
Yeah.
And he says, okay, watch me very carefully. And it just melted away.
Wow.
And there he was, you know. Actually, I shouldn't say he was she. And her name is Charmaine. We roughly call it Charmaine. But
okay.
it sounds like
a guttural
type. It's kind of like a chutzpah,
okay,
you know, kind
okay,
of sound.
Yeah.
And we talked, and I didn't ask a million questions. I asked just a couple of key questions, and I said, "You're hanging out in our temple. How long you've been hanging out in our temple?" He said, "We've been hanging out with your tradition for years." I said, "Can you show me that?" And she walked me into our prayer room and asked for certain Tibetan texts. We had copies of them, okay? You know, those long rectangular ones, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she opens it up, and there's artwork, and there are the ancient monks with these beings. And then she took me back into prayer room, and we're looking at one of the big 6-foot-high, 4-feet-wide Tanka paintings with the goddess Tara sitting there with all her retinue of all her her entourage of enlightened beings, and said, look carefully at the enlightened beings. And I looked around, and they just looked like everybody else. And then I got down to the bottom, and there on 4 different lotus leaves were 4 of them in lotus positions.
Wow.
In a blissful state. And I went, oh my goodness, I never saw them there. They're enlightened beings, and they're gentle, smart, and I am honored to know one.
That's interesting. Are they in the general population, or do they take solace in temples or places of, you know, like...
They're everywhere. I've run it. I've, now that I know what to look for and I can see them.
Okay.
Okay. I've
run into them at Target.
No, amazing enough, but I bumped into them in DC. I bumped into them on the subway.
Wow.
You know, and because I know what to look for now, I'm aware of their signature, and I'll look at them, and they'll look at me, and they'll try to look away, and I'll say...
But they know you know?
They know I know. Okay. I'm marked somehow, okay? And they know I know. And a couple of times, I was at some kind of a function. I want to say UFO MegaCon, and two individuals came up to my table, were talking to me, and I looked at one of them, and I saw her eyes for a moment, and I said, and I used a particular word that I had learned from Charmaine.
Okay.
And she looked at me. I said, would you like to go for a walk and discuss what I just said? And she invited me for a walk, and this very lovely blonde lady, we went down for a long walk, got away from everybody, and she dropped the glamour around her eyes, and I could very clearly see that 6-inch goggle area around her eyes, and I clearly knew what she was.
Yeah.
And we talked. She asked me how I knew about them, and I told her, and we had a very lovely chat. And but there's lots of them here, watching over us, helping us, nudging us, inspiring people, encouraging people.
Okay. Now, do they have any type of like healing abilities or clairvoyant, clairaudient? I mean, like...
They're enlightened beings. They are completely open to
all of things.
It.
Okay. All right.
Completely open to all of it.
I've heard that so many times that the reptilians are here to be protectors or watchers. It's just...
Yes. They are.
Yeah, and it's just...
Whoever the secret societies are on our planet that are fighting that are the ones that keep telling us that they're all these evil people, they're these evil beings. Now, there is a renegade version of the reptilians out there. Yes, there is. But the ones that I have met are... they're not drawing all this big muscular, you know, type thing. They're very gentle looking, very soft looking. To look at their face, I'll give you an example. It's a little more humanoid, but remember on Fred Flintstone, remember Dino?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Imagine kind of a face, something like that, but a tad more humanoid.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
and quite green and, they like various foods that we have, vegetables particularly, and if we wanted to bring their entire culture to its knees, a truck of pepperoni pizzas would do it.
Oh, you could stop me with it.
No, it's the pepperoni intoxicates them.
Oh, I see.
And
sorry.
I got Charmaine intoxicated on that.
Oh, my God.
And I'll never do that again. you've never dealt with somebody who's got a 6-foot tail that weighs 40 pounds. You know, so you don't.
And that's just something you can always live on is, what have you done lately? Nothing. Well, I got an alien drunk.
But that's a running joke about that. And but the deal was, the talks we had were less like what I would call the woo-woo UFO talk, and was more the conversation of, we were in a Buddhist context, we were in a temple context, and we started having very deep conversations about what we in Buddhism call Dharma, and we just how... the force works, and how we interact with the force, and that kind of a flavor, you know, and the conversations were deep. It was just, I was just talking with another Lama, you know, and so a year after I met her, our big Lama came from India, Tibetan guy. He's the head of the conservative tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. There's four great traditions, one really conservative, two intermediate conservatives, and then the Dalai Lama's in the liberal tradition. We think he's a radical. But no, I love him. And we had 60 monks and nuns, mostly nuns, and Lama, after the congregation left from the big teaching, 400 or 500 people left the temple, his aides came out, and we set up barbecue pits. He liked American hot dog and weenie bus. Okay. And the little 60-year-old llama came out, and he's a little guy, and he just loved to play basketball with the young monks. We had some monks that were like college age, maybe out there playing, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. So at one point, this one nun looked over at llama and he's eating his burger and said, holding this, she says, you know, we talk about other beings. Are there other beings off world? You know, he says, yes. He says, are there other beings on the moon? He says, yes. And he looks around at all the monks and nuns. He looks at me and this other novice. We're novices. We're the two flunkiest novices there. Please understand that. They would not give us the time of day, most of the rest of the monks and nuns. And he looked at us and, you two have been touched by the dikinis, the sky dancers.
Oh, my gosh.
And, I'm marked. I knew about the mark because, like I said, I'd be on a subway. They knew I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And they said to me, he says, so how many species are on the moon? I look to Vicky. Vicky looks at me. When? It's seasonal. And he says, right now. It's busy. Vicky looks at me. Five. He says, okay, there's your answer, five. The rest of the monks and nuns would not talk to us for 3 months. They wouldn't come near us.
Oh, my God.
Okay? That's the problem in our culture. That's that stigma brush problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
And after I started doing that Art Bell-style show on the radio station, I'm a nun. I'm on doing this radio show on Saturday night for 3 hours, you know. Conspiracy theory, ancient astronauts, ancient civilizations, UFOs, you name it, on Business Talk Station in D.C. every Saturday night, okay? And they tattled on me, the holiness. So my lama comes to town. He is the head of Tibetan Orthodox Buddhism, North America.
Okay.
He comes to town. I'm his duty driver, driving around in my Saturn. And one day, we're at this long 8-minute light, and he says, so, I hear you have a weekly radio program and you talk esoteric stuff. I thought, my goodness, I am so...
Get called the principal's office.
I says, am I in trouble? No, you're not in trouble. He says, if Buddha was alive right now, he'd be like Larry King, coast to coast. I said, okay. He says, does your audience know you're a nun? He said, no, I have not told them that. You can tell them. I give you permission. Wow. You tell them. I says, I don't know if they'll put me off the air. Don't worry. I doubt it will. Do it. So the next Saturday night, I got on air and I said, I got to tell you guys something. This is what I am. And go to this website. Here's a picture of me in my robes, you know. Our audience only grew.
Yeah.
You know, it was wild. But there's funny politics in Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets complicated. But Mike, going back to our friends, the reptilians, the couple that I met... I've known five.
Okay.
And like I said, they were gentlest, politest. They have a hard grasp of some of our humor.
Okay.
Because they don't always understand our colloquialisms. A lot of humor is caged in.
Mm-hmm.
But once you kind of give them the explanation, they get the meaning of it, you know. They question the day-to-day cruelty that we see. Charmaine can't understand our current president and the insanity that put him in. Okay. That's a recent conversation.
Yeah.
And that's the whole truth.
Hmm.
And I don't believe I had that conversation on the air. okay, let's say that. It's disclosure.
Yeah.
There's a lot of human beings that have regular interaction with off-worlders.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that.
And I was treat them just like anybody else.
I was on a business trip in Colorado. I was out there for 3 months on a project I was working on in Lockheed. And I was staying in one of these extended stay places.
Mm-hmm.
And I came out to, you know, they have really good, you know, treats and water and tea available all the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out there to get some stuff. And I was getting this stuff and I looked at this lady and told her to go ahead and get the thing there. And she stops. She looks over at me. You know dragons. And I looked back at her and she dropped.
Oh.
She dropped just that amount of glamour around her eyes. I said, can we go have tea someplace in the booth? And she said, certainly. Let me get a couple of my friends.
Oh.
Oh, my goodness.
And her...
Like, how do you reconcile that? Like, do you, like...
Well, remember, I'd already had dealt with this. Yeah. Already dealt with. No longer in robes at that point. Okay. I'd left the monastery. I'm promoted. I'm a yogi these days. But what happened was... She got on the house phone, made a couple of calls, and we met in a restaurant, and there were like five of us in this booth, and the four of them were all Dracs.
Wow. Yeah.
And I'm going, wow. That's incredible. And we had a wonderful chat. And how did you meet us? How did you know us? How did you get marked? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the nature of it. And so I guess I could probably say I know I've met about 10 of them.
Okay.
Over about the last 20 years.
Hmm.
It's amazing. And I must be marked, or I must have the okay secret handshake from something at my forehead or something.
Right. Yeah,
because they tend to wake up and
they'd like to imprint your energy or your soul or whatever you want to call it.
They know.
Yeah, they know.
And it's been an incredible experience. I lived with some Burmese monks, and the last 2 or 3 years I lived in a monastery, and the Burmese monks were cool. And this is before my lama sent me off to run a center up in upstate New York for 3 years. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking to Burmese monks, and one night we were sitting there arguing some point of Dharma, and I made a crack. They didn't like a particular, remember, these are friendly monastic arguments.
Okay.
These are religious arguments, but you have an argument, it's fun because you're all showing how much y'all know about something. And I made some crack about something, and when I made the crack, one of the senior monks, one of the venerables, he looked at me, and he sat there looking at me, and he says, "You've been touched by off-worlders." And I said, "I'd rather not get into that." He said, "Don't worry, I know lots of people have been touched by them, you know, and it's all very good, you know."
Yeah.
And he came up to my room a couple of days later, and he happened to look in my closet. I'm in the live action role play games, LARP.
Okay.
And he looked in my closet, and he sees a Soviet uniform in there, some 1930s dresses in there, a space suit in there, you know, along with my dress robes and everything.
Right.
And he says, "What is this?" And I opened up a scrapbook and showed different pictures of these different personas. He says, "Oh, they're like little mini reincarnations." Oh, I like it. do, as long as you learn, do, you know. And so this is kind of the community of people I worked with. It was fun. There was hard parts that we had to study and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
I had my most difficult times with the American monks and nuns who had been monks and nuns maybe 10 or 15 years, but they used to be Presbyterians and Baptists and Methodists and things like that before, and they brought all that baggage with them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And my lama at one point, they didn't deal with me being a transsexual very well.
Mm-hmm.
And the lama, this is the Orthodox lama, and he says, "Oh, they have no idea the gift that is sitting among them.
Mm-hmm.
They could learn so much from you, but they won't. The monks, when I got ordained, the monks wouldn't let me live with them, and the nuns wouldn't let me live with them."
Oh, geez.
And that's when he sent me out to start running some small centers and things. You know, he says, "Get an apartment, run a center, you know, please."
Yeah.
It's like, people, open your minds. Stop with your eyes and open your minds.
Well, his line is, "We're all students."
Mm-hmm.
Some students are a little advanced more than others. And he said, "This particular group of students isn't quite ready for the class and teaching that you can give them."
Mm-hmm.
But they're still monks and nuns. I got promoted and ordained as a yogi. So, you know.
There you go.
You know, it'll still buy you a cup of coffee if you pay $4. You know, so. But no, I'm an advanced teacher now.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me, there was a funny thing. There was a cute story. I don't know if we should talk about this, but no, I'll talk about it. His bearing. When I was still in robes, the Burmese monk took me to a ceremony called a katina ceremony. It's in the spring. It's after. It's actually more in the fall. It's right after the rainy season would be in India.
Okay.
And the monks and nuns were always confined to the temple or to their community huts and things during the rainy season, so they weren't out walking around doing their begging and then stamping on the new life of plants and animals that were coming up because the ground's now saturated with water and all this new life was springing forth. So the lay people by tradition, do a big spread of food, and they make gifts of new fabric to repair robes and all this sort of thing. This is a very ancient tradition. And I went to this, and there was hundreds of Sri Lankans there. It was a Sri Lankan temple we were doing this at. And I was there as a guest. I was the only Tibetan there. And I had to go do something. And I went to take a door looking for a restroom. And I got in, and the door locked behind me, and I found myself on a stage. And there was these like lazy boy recliners, and there's all these venerable monks and teachers from about a dozen different Asian traditions. We had Cambodians, we had Koreans, all Thais, and all this stuff. And they were having a monastic debate. And they saw me, and I was the only Tibetan tradition at the thing at all. He said, "Oh, Tashi, come over." And I'm sitting here, and they said, "Sit down, join our conversation." And I know what this is, and I'm going, "Oh my God. I am like the associate's degree level Buddhist nun here, novice." And these guys are all like double PhD kind of Buddhist lamas, right? I'm going, "Oh, I'm in trouble. I'll just agree with everything they say." You know, I figured that's my way out.
Like, I just walked through this door.
I'm looking for the restroom.
But that's what it amounted to. Mm-hmm. So they go down through this whole line of stuff, and they get sorted to me. And I agreed with pretty much everything they were talking about. You know, in reality, I really did. And when they got to me and they said, the moderator was an American Thai monk, and he says, "So Buddhism always adapts itself to its new culture, and it arises," because right now Buddhism in America is all pretty much imported. Okay. "And the hope is that Buddhism will arise on its own in this culture, influenced by these imports, but essentially become uniquely North American."
Okay.
And so he says, "What will it take to make Buddhism become uniquely North American?" And I looked at him and I says, "I don't think you'll like the answer. Do you mind if we pass on that one?" No, you got to take the answer. He said, "Go ahead, tell us." And I said, "You're not going to like it. Tell us." And I said, "Well, first thing we have to do is lose the Asian baggage." And you could have heard a pin drop from the 200 Sri Lankans in the audience. And so finally somebody said, "Oh, something to talk about. Yeah, you know." So we get talking, and he says, "Well, why?" And I said, "Well, first thing," I said, "you treat women like property overseas. The nuns are treated terribly. You know, the monks are just regaled and all this, but the nuns are treated like crap." And they said, "Well, you know, you got to understand 10th century scripture says, you know, women are the problem with everything, you know." And I said, "Okay." And see, the problem is.
Really?
Yes, they're the root of all evil. And of course, please understand something. They are perceiving me as a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. I let them.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I proceeded to let them do that. We argued the points out. And finally, I said, "Look. Let's go back 2,500 years. Heck with the 10th century scriptures." I said, "It's highly misogynistic." I said, "Let's go back to Buddha." I said, "The Vinaya taught us that men and women are ordained equally." And they said, "Well, yeah, but the women had 375 more vows to take because they're primitive." I said, "No, they carry the apparatus for reproduction and they have more responsibility." And then I said, "Besides that, in the Vinaya, a monk or a nun can change gender up to 3 times within 1 lifetime while in robes. Something Westerners don't know."
Yeah.
And they go, "Oh, no, that's impossible." And the Cambodian monk, "Oh, Tashi's right."
Wow.
And I says, "When they do, the vows transmute with them."
Oh.
Okay.
And I said, "Mamala, why are you defending the nuns?" I said, "Because I am a nun."
Oh, you're going to hear another pin drop.
Okay, one last statement I made. I says, "An hour from now, we're going to go outside and there's that lovely spread of food on all those tables out there. And we're all going to go out there with our begging bowls. It's an aluminum spun bowl, looks like like a bowling ball."
Okay.
"And that's what we use if we're going out to do formal begging."
Okay.
You know? And if I've done formal begging, I'll go stand on a street corner like a homeless guy and hold my begging ball out in my robes asking for donations. We give them the charity. You know? We don't beg for our food here in the States.
Right.
Usually. And so what happened was I said, "We're going to line up in ordination order, senior to junior, monks, followed by the nuns in ordination order. And any new monks that have just recently been ordained, they'll be following the nuns." I said, we're going to go out there. We're going to get this lovely food. And monks are going to sit at that nice, big, long table. And the two or three nuns that are here are going to be sitting at a little card table by themselves. Where's the equality in that?
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Right. Well, we got out there to get our material. We're getting me and two Thai nuns. We're getting ready to sit down at the card table. Little
the kids' table.
Well, it was a table, something like this. We were getting ready to sit down at this table. And we looked over at the monks on the long table, like an L, you know, and they're pointing at the empty seats at the end of their table. And then Kai Nan, it was an American monk, and she says, oh, we're not supposed to do this. I says, they outrank us. Come on.
Yeah.
So we went over to sit down, and as we're getting ready to sit down with the monks, she said, we shouldn't be doing this. I said, honey, we just climbed Everest.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's incredible.
You know? All right.
Made strides.
4 months later, I'm driving Kempo around, the dean. The headmaster.
Yeah, okay. The headmaster.
Driving around, we're at this 8-minute light going to Colonel Chicken. He loves Colonel Chicken. We're not all vegetarians either,
yeah.
You know.
Okay.
At least a 4-piece chicken meal. So we're going up to get the Colonel Chicken stuff, and he's sitting at the light. He says, so, I hear we have to lose the Asian baggage.
Once again.
Word travels fast.
And I says, holiness, how did you hear about that? Did come back through the grapevine? No, there were three Buddhist journalists in the office in the audience, and they wrote articles about it, and they quoted you.
Wow.
I said, oh, my. I said, am I in trouble? He said, no, you told the truth. I said, can we start talking the truth, Monty? He says, I can't. I'm head of the Orthodox Tibetans in North America. I can't do that. It's too political, too charged. But you can. I said, but is that a problem with me? No, you're enlightened enough to do that. Go ahead and teach it. And if it becomes a problem, we can always disavow you. You're nobody, you know. But he said, no, you go tell the truth. You're one of the few people who's uniquely qualified to tell this story.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah.
So I've been on a very long leash ever since then. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing a talk like this.
Yeah.
Right.
So you've heard about aliens from a Buddhist perspective, and you've heard about equality in Buddhist circles. There's a big fight going on right now about the fact that there's been abuse of nuns, and the truth is starting to come out.
Yeah.
And I got asked my opinion on it, and I told some truth, and boy, it rattled a lot of cages when I did. You know, this was about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
and I don't think I've heard the last of the fallout. So. But I don't care about fallout. I'll stand up to the truth anytime.
That's
right. The UFOs have been a truth, you know. And I shared with you the story about my friends, I adoringly call them my lizard friends.
Yeah.
The Klausians.
Yeah.
And they're quite lovely people, and they're enlightened. They're smart. They've got an incredible sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And you can bait them with Oreo cookies or a pepperoni pizza. Oh.
Pepperoni pizza, yeah.
That's their downfall. Honestly, goodness gracious.
That's incredible.
So that's it.
Well, we appreciate you coming and sharing all your stories with us.
You're going to edit all this out, aren't
you? No, heck no.
Hell no.
It's the first chance that we've had to speak with you, and it's been awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Meeting you is so a very, unbelievable event.
Yes. Don't stop doing what you're doing.
Let me share you one last story.
Yes. Okay.
Something one of them shared with me. They have people here who are humans,
mm-hmm.
who are connected to people on their home world. And the way, you know, when you hear people talk about quantum entanglement,
yeah.
The way English says quantum entanglement, it's like this, that our two fingers kind of wrapped together, kind of pulling on each mm-hmm. other. That's kind of like the English translation of quantum entanglement. The German word is far more explicit. It's more like this.
Okay.
Okay. Imagine that your right brain is free storage. Okay. Imagine that sort of a spiritual entanglement can be manifested. Mm-hmm. This is not possession.
Okay.
This is by mutual agreement that about 25 or 30% of the off world's being consciousness comes here, and 25 or 30% of the human's consciousness goes there.
Mm-hmm.
That consciousness is submerged, but is an observer and can come to the surface, mm-hmm. but usually is an observer. It's a good way to learn, okay? And again, same thing for the Colossian who's here is an observer and then can come out, mm-hmm. you know. And there is a number of people that are, you know, sharing somewhat enlightened people who are in a sharing relationship like that.
Okay.
And I've met one or two and then had them let the off-world visitor come through. You don't see a physical change, but boy, you see it in the eyes, mm-hmm. you hear it, see it in the mannerisms, you see it in the voice change, you certainly see it in the nature of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're sitting there talking to your friend who barely got out of high school and suddenly you're talking to a multiple PhD type of intelligence. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of thing. And there's a lot of that going on. And the Colossians are big with that.
Yeah.
They have a lot of people touched here. And gives them the eyes and ears to be observers, and it's all done at the consciousness and spiritual level.
Oh,
no technology involved beyond the Force.
Yeah.
And when I learned about that, I made a ton of notes on it, but I've been hesitant to publish on it because people think I'm stark raving mad, you know. But that's the nature of it. And I've shared it with somebody else for a change.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
This is really unbelievable.
Appreciate you sharing all your stories with us. We could talk for probably 10 more hours.
Yeah, probably could. Have me back sometime in the future. We'll
talk. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And if anybody wanted to get a hold of you, how could they reach out to you?
I guess the easiest way is reach out to me at Blogger, Blogger, mm-hmm. at Cheryl with a C, CherylCosta.com. Blogger at CherylCosta.com, and tell me that they heard me on 222 broadcast, a paranormal podcast. I'll answer the questions within limits.
Okay, all right,
great. All right, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye bye now.
Bye.
Thanks for sticking around with us, folks. Okay, Joe.
You know, when I
talk to me,
when I edit the show, I listen to the shows like 3 or 4 times, right. And this. It was just awesome. Listen to this. I mean, usually what I do when I edit is I actually listen to the show at like 1.34 speed or whatever. Mm-hmm. So everybody sounds like chipmunks.
Right.
It just helps me
get
through it faster. Mm-hmm. But I listen to the whole show. I'm so interesting. And I can't wait to meet her again.
So after we had taped and the day was over, we all went out to... Joe and I wanted to go get some food. So we went down to the lounge and we were going to have some food. And we were sitting with a couple of our friends, vendors there.
Yeah.
They do Bigfoot and jewelry. And we were just sitting there and Cheryl had come in and she's kind of looking around. And I was like, come over, sit with us. Tell everybody what she told us, what she saw there.
She said that there was a reptilian at the show. So who knows which person it was?
I was scared. I was looking around like, if there's one here, I want to know who it was.
Yeah.
I wanted to see. I'm like, I'm glamour. Yeah. I want to see. But maybe I don't. I'd probably pee my pants.
But it was great. Even at dinner, we talked for over an hour.
Yeah.
We didn't get to go out and see Andrea Perone summon the UFOs.
It was raining.
Yeah.
Boo. But
I looked at the photos and there was probably 200 or 300 people out there with her in the rain.
Yeah. If you guys really are interested in UFOs, UFO Contact is the,
is
the
show.
Conference to go to because there was a ton of people there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I mean, just the speakers were so interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't hear them all, but.
Nick Redfern was there.
Nick Redfern.
Tenney was there.
John Tenney. Hey,
Tim Woolworth.
Yes.
I mean, the place was packed. But
it was.
Yeah.
So interesting.
And it's on Houghton Lake, which is beautiful.
Ugh,
it's huge.
Gorgeous. I wanted to just jump in the water. It was crystal clear.
Yeah.
Crystal clear water. That's why Michigan's so pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, I know you guys have got a lot going on. This was a long one.
Yeah.
You might have had to break it up and had a pee break in between. That's fine. We understand. But
can you believe, I mean, she told her stories for the first time on our show.
I know. We're very grateful. Thank you, Cheryl, for sharing those with us. And we will cross paths again. And she's going to have to point out the reptilians to me because I'm curious.
I've got a few more questions, and they may not be the same questions everybody else has, you know. Like, How do they build their ships? How do they, you know, stuff like that?
We have to have her back on.
Okay.
We have questions.
Okay.
We need answers. But
we'll have a rabbit hole show with Cheryl. Yes.
I think she would love that.
Oh, she would love it.
We'll get that bowl out and just pull the random questions out of the bowl.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks everyone for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed the interview. We definitely did. Yeah, I just want to thank everyone for tuning in. Thank you for listening to this long show, which I loved it. I mean, this is one that I'm going to listen to over and over again, mm-hmm. even though I've edited it a few times. But yeah, it was awesome. Thank you, Cheryl, for being on. We're definitely going to have her back on. And yeah, rabbit hole show with Cheryl. She'll yes. love it. But anyways.
If you have questions for Cheryl, send them to us. We'll get them to her or check her out on her Facebook page.
Yeah. So let's leave with some Decepticon
Ooh.
From Dead in 5. Talk to you later.